So we just read chapter 7, 1 and 2. And I want to notice, I want to pause at the first phrase. Now it came about in the days of Ahaz. Who is Ahaz?
The son of Jotham.
The son of Jotham, who is also the son of Uzziah, who was king of Judah. Okay, we got that right. Got that down. Anybody know who the son of Ahaz was? No,
Manasseh. Hezekiah.
Oh,
Hezekiah. Manasseh
Hezekiah. Okay, Hezekiah is the son.
was Hezekiah.
Hezekiah's son was Manasseh. So Hezekiah is coming on the scene next. But right now, we're in the days of this guy, Ahaz. You can read Ahaz's story, and you want to write this down in 2 Kings 16 or in 2 Chronicles 28. Both of them are worth appealing to, and so we will. And first of all, in 2 Kings 16, some things of interest. He was 20 years old when he became king, and you'll see that in 2 Kings 2. 20 years on the reign for 16. So, how old are you? 38. See, he would have died 2 years ago. He 36 years old. All right. So he reigned 16 years. He was 20 when he began. I couldn't tell you where this is that is in Isaiah, where he, right at the beginning, middle, toward the end. We're not really told, just in his reign. But what about this guy? Now it says in verse 3, 2 Kings 16, verse 3, that he was not like, well, that's verse 2. He was not like his father David. In verse 3, he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. Now, what's the difference? Kings of Israel or David? What's
No, I don't think so.
not a single one of them. In fact, the opening salvo was, let's own religion, we'll set up our own idols of the calves, we'll set up our own priesthood, and just everything was what I want to do. And it included sacrificing to the pagan gods. And in fact, it says he made his son pass through the fire. And I'm just glad it wasn't Hezekiah. What does it mean, made his son pass through the fire? Burned him to death
Sacrifice.
in Moloch, the god that the best way I can illustrate it is kind of like one of those old Sardis burners. You just dump the kid in the top with the flaming fire, with trumpets blaring and drums pounding so you can't hear the scream of the kid or the cries of the mothers. And this king did that to his boy, okay? And then it says in verse 4, he sacrificed everywhere. 5 and 6. Then Rezin, king of Syria. Now, in Isaiah, the word is Aramea, and here it's Syria. What's the difference between Aram and Syria?
They're the same.
They're the same, just different names that are given to the same region. What is the most prominent city in Syria?
Damascus.
Damascus. Okay, that'll give you an idea of where it is. Okay, so Rezin, the king of Syria, Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to war against it, and they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him. Now, that's what we read in Isaiah, wasn't it? That in verse 1, they went up to war against Jerusalem, but couldn't conquer it. Okay, so it's consistent with the historic record. And at that time, verse 6, back in Kings, at that time, Rezin, king of Syria, recovered Eilat and for Syria and cleared the Judeans out of Eilat entirely. And the Syrians came to Eilat and sent messengers to, no, and live there to this day. So Ahaz, so he's getting whooped up on and losing territory. So he sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. Now, what's the difference between Syria and Assyria?
Serious a
They're
lot.
different countries.
They're different countries. Assyria is farther east. Nineveh was the capital. And it became a huge empire before the Babylonian Empire took over. It became an all-engulfing empire. The fascinating thing about that is what we're going to see here tonight, that the king of Judah actually prompted the massive takeover. Anyway, so he hired King Tiglath-Pileser, saying, "I am your son. Come up and deliver me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel, who are rising up against me." So Ahaz took the silver and the gold that he found in the house of Yahweh and in the treasure of the king's house, and sent a present to the king of Assyria. All right. And then the king of Assyria listened to him, went up against Damascus, captured it, carried them off exile, and so forth. Now, I want to keep your finger here, and I want to go over to 2 Chronicles 28. And a lot of the story is the same, but there I think there's some details that are will fill in some gaps and maybe fascinate you. Okay. I'm doing this primarily to get a sense of why it says here in verse 1 of Isaiah 7, or verse 2, that the heart of the king and the hearts of the people shook like trees of the forest shake when they're blown in the wind. What do they call those aspen trees in Colorado? Like quaking aspen? The wind comes and it's just, and the hearts of the people are like that. Well, why? Well, let's look at the historical background to it. Okay. Now it says in verse X, 2 Chronicles 26, "For Pekah the son of Remaliah slew in Judah 120,000 in one day." Now, that's a pretty aggressive attack, pretty effective attack. And all valiant men, because they had forsaken Yahweh, the God of their fathers. Verse 8, "And the sons of Israel." So that was Pekah the son of Remaliah. He's the king of the Israelites. And the sons of Israel carried away captive of their brothers 200,000 women, sons, and daughters, and took also a great deal of spoil from them. So 120,000 men died in the battle, and then 200,000 of their families, women and children. And so it gives you an idea of why there might be a whole lot of shaking going on, as what was his name said? And so that guy. So in verse 16, in verse 16 of 2 Chronicles 28, "At that time King Ahaz sent to the king of Assyria for help." So he hired him. We saw that also back in 2 Kings. But in verse 22, I want to drop down to, I want to look at 20. "So Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came against him and afflicted him instead of strengthening him, because Yahweh had humbled," verse 19, "had humbled Judah because of Ahaz, the king of Israel. So Tiglath-Pileser came against him." So he hired Tiglath-Pileser to help him. But when Tiglath-Pileser got there, he went against him. "I know you got plenty of money. I'll just go ahead and take it." And so in verse 22, "In the time of his distress, this same king Ahaz became yet more unfaithful to Yahweh, sacrificed at Damascus," which he just kind of yielding. "These other gods are more powerful than my God," et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that gives you a bit of the backdrop. In verse, let me keep reading here. Verse 24. "Moreover, when Ahaz gathered together the utensils of the house of God, he cut the utensils of the house of God in pieces, closed the door of the house of Yahweh, and made altars for himself in every corner of Jerusalem." You have this total shutdown of relying upon God and trying to placate the gods that can't do a thing for him. So that's the background of this story here in Isaiah 7. All right. And so everybody's heart is shaking like the trees of the forest in the wind. That's verse 2. Now let's read back in Isaiah 7. We're going to read 3 through 9. Then Yahweh said to Isaiah, "Go out now to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shear-Jashub, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the way to the fuller's field, and say to him, 'Take care and be calm, have no fear, and do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands. Counter the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah, because Aram, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have planned evil against you. Be calm, don't worry. Let us go up against Judah and terrorize it.'" This is what the kings are saying. "And make for ourselves a breach in its walls, and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it. Thus says Yahweh God, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass." All right, I'm going to stop reading there and get a sense of what's happening. So Isaiah, take him and go meet. Where was he supposed to meet him? At the end of the conduit, upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. So there's some, what's a conduit? Is the opposite of can't do it?
Aqueduct.
Or an aqueduct, or maybe an open pipe, or it could be a closed pipe, okay, for the purpose of transporting water, obviously. What's a fuller's field? Is that half empty?
Laundry.
Laundry. Yeah, fuller is laundry. And so this is where they would, guy had a professional laundromat. Well, you got, that's at the end of the conduit from the, so you'd think that you'd want to have a lot of water where you have your fullering. Fuller, is that a word, fullering, going on? "Take your son and say to him." Now, take what son? Turns out that Isaiah has two sons. We're going to see another son come into the picture later, and not too much later. But Shear-Jashub, what does that mean? It is a great question. Somebody might have a marginal note. "A remnant shall return." That's what it means. So take your boy, a remnant shall return, and go out and talk to the king. Okay. You're going to find his next boy, Mahershalal Hashbaz, means swift as the booty, speedy as the prey. These guys are going to come in, they're going to ravage you, they're going to take off with the goods, and a remnant shall return. Okay? You get the picture of his two boys? His two boys represented what was about to happen to the nation of Israel at the hands of the Assyrians and the Babylonians. They're going to come in rapidly, take your money, go away, and only a remnant of you will come back. So you take your boy, a remnant shall return, and you go meet the king. Now, what did he say to the king? "Be calm. I take care." How do you take care? You got this massive army coming at you. What's the problem? What's your biggest propensity? Panic. And in panic, you make some fearful decisions which are not well thought. So take care and be calm. And just on a practical note, just for us, when something, now we probably won't face anything quite as traumatic as this king was facing with this invading army that it had taken 120,000 of his men, might not face something quite that traumatic, but we will face traumatic things. We will face challenging things. And God's first counsel was, take care. Be calm. Now, that's not bad advice, is it? You want to deal with something very weighty? Be calm. Take care. Okay. But he also said, have no fear and don't be faint-hearted. Sometimes tackling a big problem means you got to get involved. And it might be frightening, might be scary, might be challenging, might be seemingly overwhelming. He says, don't be faint-hearted. Now, here's the cool thing. He says, because these two stubs of smoldering firebrands. Alan, do you know what a smoldering firebrand is? That's just a branding iron. Anybody who has ever made a campfire and grabbed a stick and pulled it out and saw the embers that are glowing and it's smoldering, that's a smoldering firebrand. And Smokey Bear says to put out a fire, you spread it apart and douse it with water. But spreading it apart, even that, ultimately, unless there's a wind that picks up, some other thing, that thing will die out because it needs the support of the other woods to keep going. But he's calling the two kings. See? These two kings, Rezin and Pekka, he's calling them smoldering firebrands. He says, you don't need to be afraid of those guys. They're hot now, but they're going out. They're smoldering firebrand. But notice these smoldering firebrands have fierce anger on account of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah. Fierce anger. What does it take to kill 120,000 soldiers in a day? There's some aggression going on there. Fierce anger. So, fierce anger and five and evil. This is not flying off the cuff, just getting angry and going out and doing something. This is a plan. It is a plan to attack, a plan. In fact, the plan included what? What were they planning to do?
Terrorize.
Terrorize. What's the breach? It says terrorize, make for ourselves a breach in its walls. Now, this is the result of the siege. Jerusalem, the days of Jesus, was able to last for 3.5 years under Roman attack. And the thing that finally brought it down really was the fact that internally they were divided. They had divided and partitioned through that's within the city.
Destroying each other's pastures.
They destroyed each other's
Ooh.
supplies, food supplies, water supplies. And so I'm saying all that to say that Jerusalem was a very unassailable city. It was hard to conquer. The walls were such. And so, but the plan is let's make a breach in the wall. They planned evil. Let's go up and terrorize it. What happens when you terrorize people? They get terrorized.
They get frozen.
Yeah, they're not able to take care and be calm. See, the and so they're terrorized and they act in panic and you can't formulate a plan that might be long range because the people are in a terror. So we'll terrorize it. We'll make a breach in the wall. What's the third thing they wanted to do?
Set up a new king.
Put a different king in there, somebody they could control. See? We'll set up Tabeel, the son of Tabeel, as king. Okay, so that's the plan. And it's an aggressive plan. And it's one where God says to him, take care and be calm. Don't fear and don't be faint-hearted. You're going to have to act. Act courageously, but be calm. Make rational choices. And so God says, and I'm going to be 7 now, thus says Yahweh God, it shall not stand, it nor shall come to pass. For the head of Aram, Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Now within 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered, no longer a people. And the head of Ephraim, Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. So that's what you're dealing with. You're not dealing with this massive empire. Did you pick up that thought there? Within 65 years, Ephraim will what? Be shattered. That's Ephraim.
Size.
That is the capital tribe of the 10 northern tribes, the capital Samaria there in Ephraim. But it was a leading tribe. So then 65 years, they're going to be gone. And so, you know, don't worry about them. What's next? God says, don't worry. Ahaz was trembling. God says, if you will not believe, you will surely not last. If you will not believe, it doesn't say if you do not believe, it says if you will not believe. What does will imply? Choice. It's whether to believe me or not. Is there any basis for believing what God said? Is there anything in history that proves both his will and his power to deliver? Do his people have evidence of that? Just because they were ignoring it didn't mean they didn't have the evidence of it, right? Do we have any evidence of God's both his will and his ability to deliver? He emptied heaven. He asked his son to leave his throne and come down and be born in a food trough, a manger, a fly-infested livery stable. Made him come and be born there and then go through all that he would. Any evidence that God willing to deliver, and then able to put Jesus to death, God raised him right back from out of the grave. Okay. And so we have it in spades. They might have had it in clubs. We have it in spades. They might have had some really powerful evidence. We have even more. Okay? So if you will not believe, that's a good saying. If you choose not to believe, if you choose not to believe, you will not stand. And people, that's a really good thing to share in your heart and find a way to share it with people you know. You know, if they choose not to believe, they're not going to stand. There's no chance. I mean, that way, how important is the message that you choose not to believe? You're not going to stand. Anyway, thoughts on that? So, worried about the invasion. And God says, they're just firebrands. They're not going to last another 60 years. I can deliver you. But if you choose not to believe, you're going to stand either. Okay. And so, this is another occasion. Then, the voice spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask us. So he says, if you choose not to believe, you won't stand. Ask me for a sign. What's the value of a sign? Proof?
Yeah.
That is evidence. I'm telling you that these guys aren't going to last, and you don't need to be afraid of them. Ask the sign. Ask me something that will validate you that I'm telling you that. Now, this was not man saying, well, I don't know if I believe you, God, so I want a sign. That might be upsetting. But this is God saying, ask me a sign. What sign can I give you? What can I, here's the way I see it. What can I do for you to make it easier for you to believe? Because if you choose not to believe, you aren't going to stand. So how can I help you? Go ahead.
It's just so kind.
It is.
Amazingly kind.
The kindness of God. He says, make it as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. Now, which one of those can you see? All means, by very definition, unseen. As heaven. Make it that. Don't just like Hezekiah, his son, later said, I'd like to see the sundial go back. It's easy to see the sundial go forward, right? It always does. I'd like to see it go back. And God made the sundial go back. That was a puny sign compared to what God was offering, right? As high as earth, as deep as Sheol. I will prove to you that that these guys aren't worth worrying about, that I can take care of you. Notice we saw the wickedness of Ahaz, sacrificing his sons in the fire. Can you imagine? You had a son. Can you imagine rolling him into the fire when he's not even a toddler yet? You can't even fathom it. And yet, I did it. And God is wanting to win him back. If you will not believe, you will not stand here. Ask me a sign. You see how good God is? How patient God is? How far-reaching to win the hearts of man God is? So, ask sign for yourself from Yahweh your God. Make it deep as Sheol or high as heaven. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test Yahweh. Then he said, listen now, O house of David. Is it too slight a thing for you to try the patience of men? You will try the patience of my God as well. Therefore, he himself will give you a sign. I'll give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey at the time he knows to refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy knows to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. You see any problems with that? Any complications? Any challenges with this sign?
Actually, we're not pretty sad.
Or does it? You talking about what's going to happen? Or is he talking? You understand the point? Is he dealing with current things as a sign to Ahaz, or is he dealing with later things as a sign to you and me?
Yeah.
Scott says yes. Obviously, yes is habit. The eyes have it. Do you remember in Galatians 4? Paul talked about the not allegory. Was it allegory of Sarah and Hagar? Allegory
Allegory.
of Sarah and Hagar. Well, Sarah and Hagar lived years before Paul wrote Galatians. But Sarah represented the bearing a child according to promise, whereas Hagar had a child the natural way. And Sarah said, cast out the handmaiden and her children, they will not inherit with mine, the son of the promise. And Paul says, we Christians are the sons that have been born according to promise. And the natural Jews are the sons of court born according to the flesh. They're being cast out, and you're inheriting. You see what he did? He took an historical reality and made it an allegory of the spiritual truth that was to follow. Think you have the same thing here. You have a statement that had to have some traction with the king for it to make any sense. That by the time a child born to a young maiden, a virgin can be simply young maiden, doesn't necessarily imply having had no relations with a man, doesn't demand that, the Hebrew word. And it appears to be that Isaiah's own son is the item that is used for the boy and the birth, and the fact that before he's old enough to know right from wrong, there will be plenty of food. Okay. Now, Isaiah doesn't tell us at this point why and how there'll be plenty of food, but that's the sign. And obviously, the virgin birth of Jesus was a miracle beyond miracles. And it was proof that God is able to deliver. But here, something that illustrated that in history was also a proof that God is able to deliver. So I'm going to give you a sign. By the way, I'm not going to test Yahweh. What is that? Pardon?
arrogance.
Or arrogance or false humility, or I wouldn't even dream of testing your God. Pardon? But that's what it really is. Ask a sign, and you aren't testing God if you do what he asks you to. You're testing God if you refuse to do what he asks to do. And so he says, why are you trying the patience of my God? Why are you doing that? All right. Now, he also says, and I should have picked up on this in verse 2, but he says it again here in verse 13, House of David. Who's he talking to? He's talking to Ahaz. But who is Ahaz? King in the lineage of David. And so this is the house of David. Who is Jesus? What? Remember what the blind guys called him? Son of David, have mercy on us. They acknowledge piece of truth that Jesus was of the house of David. Fallen as it was, that's where he was. Okay. So she'll bear a son. Now watch what it says. Call his name Emmanuel. Emmanuel means God with man. God with us, God with mankind. You can almost see it in the name itself. M as in, and then man, and then L, God, in God, or among men. Okay. And so, but it says he will eat curds and honey at the time he knows to refuse evil and choose good. You know what's interesting about that thought right there to me? There's a time when kids are innocent, aren't they? They're better. That's the way we say it. They don't know any better. But there's a time when they know to make a choice. And you get that. He knows to refuse evil and choose good. He knows that I should do that and I should do this, and he makes that choice. By the time, so there's a time in a child's life when he makes that transition from not knowing, just being an innocent kid doing what he does, to where he knows that he's done wrong. He knows he's violated his conscience. And fortunately for us, there's a God who is able to heal us when we mess up our con or defile our conscience. Anyway, he says, before that kid is able to do that, these two kings will be, the dread of these two kings will be gone. The land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. All right. But what's the with Ahaz? If you will not believe, you will not stand. It says, Yahweh will be on you, on your people, and on your father's house such days as have never come since the day that Ephraim separated from Judah. There's quite a conflict between Judah and Ephraim. The two southern tribes and the 10 northern tribes when they split. Probably not much different in intent of when the South decided to secede in the Battle of the States in our history, that there was this war, this brother going into war against cousin or uncle or brother. And so the same, he says, such time as the days that Ephraim separated from Judah, I'm going to bring a people, you and your people on your father's days, such days as has never come. I'm bringing the king of Assyria. And it will come about in that day that Yahweh will whistle for the fly that is in the remotest part of the rivers of, and the bee that is in the land of Assyria. What's he talking about? Whistle for the fly, whistle for the bee. What's he talking about? He'd have just pecked, pardon? I'm sorry? No. Calling, beckoning him. What do you do when you whistle for a dog? For the dog. And then whistle for the fly. Come on and fly. And whistle for the bee. Where's the fly coming from? Where's the bee coming from? Other countries. I'm going to be calling like the plagues upon you. I'm going to be calling for the armies of Egypt and the armies of Assyria to come in to you. That's essentially what he did here. Okay. In that day, notice in that day, what day? Such days in verse 17, such days. Then you have here in verse 18, in that day. Then you have in verse 20, in that day, and then you have in verse 21, in that day. So those are like a daisy chain connecting the thoughts. Here's what's going to happen in that day. I'll whistle for the fly and bring it on in. In that day, Yahweh will shave with a razor hired from regions beyond the Euphrates with the king of Assyria, the head and hair of the legs, and it will also remove the beard. Thoughts on that, Scott? We're going to shave you bald by the king that's coming in. Okay. But there's also, you remember in the days of David, he sent something to the king, the king of, was it Moab? I think it was Moab.
Might have been. I don't
He
remember.
lost his father, and so he's come as David sent a
No, it was
consolation.
up north somewhere.
No, it was just north of the Dead Sea. I think it was Moab. And what happened was his counselor said, "Oh, he's trying to spy out the land." So they took the count, they took the emissary and cut off half their beard, and sent him home. Big, big disgrace. Cut off half their garment. Yeah, sent him big disgrace. And so there's probably some of that going on here too. Now it will come about in that day, verse 21, that a man may keep alive a heifer and a pair of sheep. And it will happen that because of the abundance of the milk produced, he will eat curds. Now, he may keep alive what? A flock of sheep? A herd of cattle? A single one. And have an abundance of milk or curds. What does that tell you? There's a good cow, a good milking cow. God's watching out for him. You're still missing the point. Why will they have enough if they have a little?
Hardly any people to feed.
There aren't very many people left. Thank you, Jim. Got there for us. Got there for. Yeah, there just aren't very many people left. They're all going to be hauled off into captivity. Okay, but in that day, the people who are left are going to have plenty. And it will happen that because of the abundance of the milk produced, he will eat curds. What was it said? Before the boy knows how to eat, knows good or from evil, they will eat curds. Okay. Now, part of the reason is most of the people are going to be gone. Why are they going to be gone? Let's figure this one out. Why are they going to be gone? Is it going to be because of Rema or Pekah and Remaliah? When, and we saw this in 2 Chronicles 28. When Ahaz hired the Assyrian king had motivation to come just sweep down through the entire coastal plain and take everybody captive. And when he got to Ahaz, take him captive too. But didn't honor the pact that they made. But it was Ahaz that invited the scourge to come into there. He was afraid of these two kings. And wasn't trusting God to protect him from these two small kings. So he hired the big king from the east, and the big king from the east just came and took care of those two kings, sure enough, and then took care of him too. And so if you will not believe, you will not stand. Sometimes the solutions that we see to our problems seem like they're going to be pretty good solutions. God says, not this time. And so he used the very king that Ahaz hired to help him to dominate him and take him and his people captive. When we get to chapters 38 and 39, we will see the impact of the Assyrian coming into their territory. I say a little bit more about that if we get into chapter 8 tonight. I think we can. So he's going to have curds and honey, and it will come about. I'm reading 23 now. It'll come about that every place where there used to be a thousand vines. What do you call that? There used to be a thousand vines in that place. What would you call that?
Your
A vineyard. Good. At 1,000 shekels of silver, it would become briars and thorns. What's happened?
would be there.
Nobody to tend, and so it's just over. You know, one of the things that my wife does every year about this time, and now she's got professional help over here. Justin works with her. She cuts back the blackberries. And what happens, Scott, if you don't cut back the blackberries?
You get
As Susan said, they take over the yard. They take over. Well, you know, because you can't get to most of the berries if you let them take over. You just can't. I've often wondered what would happen if you let the blackberries and the groom go on the same field. War for dominance. Okay, so we have this the briars and thorns taking over the vineyards, and it will come about, and they'll come out there with bows and arrows. Now, normally you'd go to the vineyard with harvest tools or pruning tools or a hoe to, but they're going to come bows and arrows. Because all the land will be briars and thorns. What are they doing with bows and arrows there?
Hunting.
Hunting! Yeah. They're not warding off invaders. They're hunting for game. And as for all the hills, which used to be cultivated with the hoe, you will not go there for fear of briars and thorns, but they will become a place for the pasturing, for pasturing oxen and sheep to trample. Just go out and let your livestock run loose on where you used to have your garden and your vineyard and your orchard, because you won't be there to take care of it. If you don't believe, you won't stand. Okay, any thoughts?
I just, I think it's, as far as I've never really read Isaiah before, but it's just really, it's kind of awestruck to me how, in this section, God's asking Ahaz to ask, to test him, to show
Yeah,
him,
I
that,
want to prove myself to you. Yeah.
which is, it's kind of, just it's awestruck striking because, normally it's the other way around.
Yeah.
When people are in such dire straits or they're in, turmoil or, feeling traumatized or anything like that, they're normally it's the go-to to pray to God and
Yeah.
ask him for a sign.
Yeah.
That he's real, that that you're going to help me make it
Will
through this.
you be there for me?
Right.
Et cetera. Yeah. Yeah. Good.
And
Good.
it's
Good
just
thought.
kind of creepy. It's lit, and he's the one asking,
Yeah.
to be, let me show you a sign.
Yeah. I want to prove to you that I'm here for you.
Yes.
Okay. Would you like to come teach the class? Nice words. Okay, chapter 8. If we can get down to verse 8, I will be happy camper. Then Yahweh said to me, take for yourself. So we've got the, if you will not believe, you will not stand, then ask a sign. And then here's this next series. Okay. Then Yahweh said to me, take for yourself a large tablet and write on it in ordinary letters, swift as the booty, speedy. And I will take to myself faithful witnesses, testimony, Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah. So I'm going to have witnesses for this tablet thing. So I approached the prophetess, and she conceived and gave birth to one. Then Yahweh said to me, name him Mahershalal Hashbaz, which means swift as the booty, speedy as the prey. So you're going to write this name on a tablet. These two guys are going to witness that, and then you're going to have a kid, and you're going to name him that. For before the boy knows how to cry, my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. Now, isn't that what he said back in chapter 7? Before the boy knows to choose right from wrong, these two kings will be gone. Here he's saying, go have a child, name him, swift as the booty, speedy as the prey, and before he knows to say mom and dad, the king of Assyria is going to take these guys away. And like I said, it was interesting that he's the one that invited the king of Assyria to come in for the purpose of stopping them. But who's going to stop the king of Assyria after he stopped them? Okay. Then I'm going to use him. We'll see when we get to chapter 10. He's just the axe in my hand. I'm just cutting you down with him. Okay, but that's ahead of time. Now, again, Yahweh spoke to me further. So first of all, any thoughts on that section of the book? Now we know that Isaiah has two sons, and that'll come into play next week when we see where he says, I and the children that God has given me are for signs. Okay, two sons, what are their names? First one,
a remnant.
Shear Jashub, a remnant shall return. Second one, Maher Shalal Hashbaz, swift is the booty. What does that mean? Swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. And don't think of booty in the way that you might think of booty. Booty is a pirate's plunder, okay? Pirate's plunder, not what? Keep it clean. This is a family class. Okay. Swift is the booty. What does that mean? Speedy is the prey. What's the prey? Okay. Generalizing, prey are the people who are conquered. Booty is the loot that's been taken.
Yes.
And it's swift. And it's speedy. So it's about to happen to you. That you are going to be quickly ravaged and despoiled. Okay, Michael? I thought I saw your square light up. All right.
Sorry, I thought I clicked it, Ms. Talkett. I was just agreeing with
okay.
you.
Well, good. I want to raise. And Yahweh again spoke to me further, saying, inasmuch as these people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloh. What's he mean? They've rejected the gently flowing water. What's he talking about? And rejoice in Rezin and the son of Remaliah. Now, therefore, behold, Yahweh is about to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates. What's he talking about? It's figurative language, right? What are the gently waters of Shiloh?
The peace of protection of God.
Yeah, God is their king. David said in Psalm 23, he makes me lie down where? And beside still waters. And there's no chance of a flood or being, I mean, wasn't that horrible? That flash flood that wiped out that girls' camp in Texas 6 or 7 months ago, whenever it was. I mean, it's just devastating. The gently flowing waters. No dangers there. My people have rejected those. Jeremiah, 100 years later, talking to the same people, say, my people have committed two evils. They've rejected the fount of living water and hewn for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns, which can hold no water. What's a cistern?
It's a place that holds water.
I point to her because she grew up where everybody in the area had a cistern. It caught the roof, the rainwater off the roof and stored it because that was the only soft water they had that they could use for washing. They wouldn't drink it, but they could wash in it. Okay? It was a cistern. But so here's this artesian that God says, I am the fountain of living water. I mean, again, I'm talking about Jeremiah. And my people have rejected me, the fountain of living waters, and hewn for themselves cisterns, which only collect groundwater. But they're broken cisterns, so they can't even hold water. And he's talking about their idolatry. Okay, God is a source of life, and idolatry is a source of brokenness. Here, my people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloh. I would be to my people a protection, calm, provision. They rejected that, and rejoice in Rezin and the son of Remaliah. Now, therefore, behold, Yahweh is about to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates. What do you suppose he's talking about there? The strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates.
Assyria.
I've already seen that that's who's coming. But the picture is this, a picture of flood. Even the king of Assyria in all his glory, and it will rise up over all its channels, over all its banks. Now, when that happens down here in the Auburn Puyallup Valley, what? I remember, you aren't old enough to remember this, Alan, but I remember before Howard Hanson Dam put up over, I remember this valley covered from hill to, east hill to west hill with water 2 or 3 feet deep. I remember that. Remember seeing it. Okay, that's a flood. It's devastating. Now, for the sharecropper, for the farmers in the area, that was gold, because it deposited silt and enriched their land. But that was the flood. Even the king of Assyria in all his glory, and it will rise up over all its channels and go over all its banks. Then it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass through. It will reach even to the neck. Now, you ever been in water up to your neck? What's about to happen? You're about to drown. I remember one time I was, I think it was Steel Lake, but it might have been Shadow Lake, one of the two. I was in, and I was with my cousin, and I was standing on the ground. I was up to here, and then, I don't know, some wave action, and I found myself backing up, and I'm out on my tiptoes, and just, you know, water up to my nose. And I was panicky. I thought, this is it. I, you know, somebody help. And somebody would have. David was there. He would have helped me. But here, it's up to the neck. What's the neck? What's he talking about? The water has come up to the neck. But now that's the picture. But what's he talking about? What is he trying to convey? To yeah. There were 42, if I got this information correct, I think I do, 42 walled cities in Judah, not in Israel, in Judah. And the Jerusalem was one of them. And the last city that Sennacherib had to take was Jerusalem. And he was about to surround, we'll see when we get to chapter 28 what that looks like. But all the walled cities of Judah had fallen to Sennacherib, and only Jerusalem was left. I think that's what he's talking about here. The waters will, the flood of this nation, flooding us. And picture the terminology. It will be a flood. Okay? In Revelation 12, when the invasion of the Roman Empire is described, it's described as a flood that Satan, a flooding river that Satan intended to wipe out the church of Jesus Christ. But instead, it wiped out Jerusalem. The land helped the women, and it swallowed the flood. So this language right here will help inform that. But here's the picture, see? It's just about to take you out. When we get to chapters 38 and 39, we will see the actual history of that. 38 and 39 is just a verbatim insertion from the book of 2 Kings. And the spread of its wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. What an interesting way to stop. What does that mean? Will fill the spread of its wings. Now it's gone from being a flood to some kind of predatory bird, for example. The spread of its wings will fill your land, the breadth of your land. Oh, Emmanuel. Isn't that an interesting way he says that? He doesn't say, oh, Judah, because he's talking about Judah. But the land that belongs to Emmanuel will be swarmed by the Assyrian army. But that's not the end of it. We're going to see as we get into the rest next week. We'll finish chapter 8 and get into chapter 9. And I think you'll be amazed at what you see. But that's all the tickler I'm going to give you on that one. Any thoughts? Okay.
So it says your lamp, Emmanuel's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that mean God's lamp?
Yeah. Or this virgin born one that's coming. Say, we'll see him called out in chapter 9. To us a child is born, to us a son is given. Almighty Father or everlasting Father, you know, all those titles that are his. But that's whose land it is. And they're messing it up. But thoughts?
Yeah, question, Rod.
Okay.
I'm still confused. I'm still confused about chapter 7, verse 14. Is that talking about Jesus?
Yeah.
Is verse 15 talking about Jesus?
7:15. Let me go back and see what 7:15 says.
Yeah.
Kurt. I don't think so.
No.
No. I think let me back up and say what I said. This is talking about Isaiah's son, the immediate fulfillment of verse 14. But just like the birth of Isaac and Ishmael became an allegory of what God was planning to do and ultimately did, so the birth of Isaiah's son is an allegory of the one who is to come. But it's Isaiah's son who know to refuse evil and choose good and eat curds. And so we saw that then in, where did we see it? In verse 4 of chapter 8, before the boy, your son knows to cry out, my father or my mother. It's a plot to that prediction to Isaiah's son. I struggled with this for years, Jim, and I may or may not have it right, but I think you have this prophecy within a prophecy, a fiction for Isaiah and the people of his day, but it's also a prophecy of God's deliverance, which is what this was about, God's ability to deliver. If you don't believe, you won't stand. And we're going to see that the deliverance from this darkness, as we get to the end of chapter 8, the people who won't listen to God will be plunged into darkness. The people that do listen to God will have to hunker down and hide. That then there will be a time when they'll see a great light. Well, that's 9, 1 and 2. That's quoted in Matthew 4, saying it was fulfilled in Jesus. So you've got this darkness because they refuse to believe, ultimately being dispelled by Jesus. And I think the picture here is of an encouragement to that current generation to trust God and be part of those that believed Isaiah and would hide themselves until the storm passed, because God would deliver. It's something to just keep noodling on, Jim. Because as you pointed out, there's some things that make you wonder. And
well, verse 15 says he will eat curds and honey at the time he knows, and the he there is capitalized. That's what kind of threw me.
Well, that's a choice of the translators. There's nothing in Hebrew that would demand one way or the other. And I think as I have discovered many times, the translators miss, in my estimation, they miss what the author was saying.
So verse 15 does not apply to Jesus. It applies to Isaiah's son only.
That makes sense.
The dual prophecy is only verse 14.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
And that's because what you said, the allegory is not the eating, it's the birth of
right
him.
Yeah. And I think verse 14 primarily applies to Isaiah's son.
Right.
But allegorically applies to Jesus. Just like the birth of Isaac really happened. The cutting off of Ishmael really happened, but they're allegorical of what God was going to do with those born according to promise and those born according to the flesh when Jesus came. And to me, the message in Galatians that lined that out like that helped me with this, to see that, oh, he's talking about his own son, but it's an allegory of God's son. He's talking about trusting for deliverance from an aggressive, oppressive captor, and he's applying it allegorically to trusting him for deliverance from a worse captor than that.
And the Old Testament is full of those allegories.
Yeah. Yes, full of the allegories, and I might say in addition to that, the motifs continue to cycle. And you see it over and over and over again. God wants his people to know, I'm there for you. If you will not believe, if you choose not to believe, you won't stand, but I'm there for you. So,
the concept.
Yeah. Here we are in what we might call the West, where we want things to be logical, black and white. And we're dealing, however, with the mind of the East, the culture of their way of expressing an idea. And the more we allow what we see in the text to mold the way we think about it, the better off we'll be. In a way, it reminds me of that time I went to Germany, and my brother-in-law and we drove from central Germany all the way to the north. And the whole time he had the radio on, and all I could hear was German. It's like I was immersed in. And I found, I literally, Alan, I found myself mouthing how to make that sound. Because we don't have umlauts, umlauted vowels. We don't have those. And yet you could hear it. And the more you heard it, you could feel your mouth muscles in your mouth start form the sound. And by analogy, the more we allow ourselves to think like a Jew by reading their literature, the clearer these concepts are going to become. That's been my experience anyway through time. Any other thoughts?
No.